CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
I didn't know what I was witnessing, to be perfectly honest. You know, it was,
yeah,
I don't think a lot of people knew what they were witnessing, yeah, I mean, even as they were watching the film.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And Barrett Sher.
Hi.
We have a very special guest. It's writer-director Chase Palmer, whose movie A Naked Singularity comes out in theaters August 8th and on demand August 13th. Chase, welcome.
Hi, guys. Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Just want to know, how did you get involved with this project?
A producer that I've known for an awful long time named Tony Gans had been developing Naked Singularity, from the book for many years, probably like 7 years before I came aboard. So he approached me with a script that was written by David Matthews and with the book. And I first read David's script and I thought he did some lovely work, and there was something, it got me intrigued enough to go into the book. And the book is a wild beast. It's something like 700, 800 pages. And kind of reminded me of this David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, in terms of just sort of all the different kind of literary kind of routes it goes down. But the most intriguing thing about it was, it was written by a public defender named Sergio de la Pava. He is married to a public defender who works in Brooklyn named Susanna. They've both been doing this for a very long time. And what struck me was the voice of the book was just amazing. It was funny and absurdist and outraged and wild and philosophical, and had these, this sort of genre mashup going on in it, and these metaphysical kind of flights of fantasy. There's just so many different elements that were specific to his sort of entry point to show his experience as a public defender. And it wasn't, I don't know, it just seemed like a new and fun way to explore some of these issues of social justice and the sort of the dysfunction of the criminal justice system from the perspective of, somebody who's lived it every day. So once I read the book, I was hooked, and I wanted to go back into the book and do a draft of the script, just really trying to channel the spirit of Sergio's voice and the spirit of the book, which is all those things I just described.
Tell me what your casting process is like, because this is one of the this cast is just got a lot of appealing people in it. John Boyega, Olivia Cooke. It's got Bill Skarsgård. It's got Tim Blake Nelson. It's got Linda Lavin, Ed Skrein. All these people are amazing. So what was it like? Did you just feel like you hit the jackpot with this cast?
I absolutely did. I mean, I started with John. By the time I was finishing writing the script, John was the guy. Like, I really felt like he was Cassie. So he was the first person we went to, and we waited for him to finally read, and luckily he responded. And I think with John, he's got sort of this sense of integrity, this sense of sort of indignation about the world around him, this kind of quiet gravitas that I'd seen in other films, particularly, with Detroit. I thought his work in that was really extraordinary. It was a hard movie, hard performance to give, because he's really reactive the entire time. He can't really act given the situation, but you could sort of see the range of emotions that he's going through. And, I felt like that Cassie was sort of experiencing a version of that. He's able to push back more, but that performance that and John's sort of public advocacy for social justice felt like it was a nice fit for this character, that he would connect to Cassie. And so, we started there. And he was the anchor for the rest of it.
I don't know what it is about, I'm sitting there watching this movie is an American tale, mm-hmm. but you have three Brits and you have a Swede, who are like just killing it with American accents and everything. Why are these guys so much better at accents than we are? Why do they do that to us?
I just don't know. I have to say, like, we were not expecting to cast three Brits and a Swede. You know, we just kept casting the right, mm-hmm. what we felt were the right folks, and then hoped that, you know, that all these guys are so, you know, they're all so professional and all so prepared. Everybody worked with dialect coaches and came, you know, to the movie ready to go and, you know, in character and, you know, having a mastery of what version of the New York accent they were going to be doing. You know, they're all slightly different. So we just, you know, these guys are good at what they do. And I just, we're trying to cast the right, the best actor versus the right, you know, nationality. And we, you know, we got lucky.
I'm guessing that the casting of Bill Skarsgård is not a coincidence, considering you worked on It, where he was Pennywise, and you were a screenwriter on It. Or was it a coincidence that it happened?
No, not at all. I mean, I did not meet Bill during production. I was working with Cary Fukunaga on that draft for a couple of years before Muschietti took over. But almost all our work is in that film, and struggled with making sure that Pennywise was a fully realized character. And I thought we did as best a job as we could do. And then when I saw what Bill did with that character, I had such respect for it. It was amazing. Like, he basically took what was on the page and what we thought was, you know, strong start on the page, and then just brought it to a whole new, like, place. So, you know, when I, having worked inside the machine of that movie and then seeing what he did with it, it was a no-brainer that he would, that I would go to him for this. And it was fun to see him cast as, you know, as that character, because we've not really seen him do that before. You know, he's usually playing more dramatic, brooding kind of characters, and he was, you know, he was the devil on John's shoulder in the film, right? He's almost like the id character, and he's bigger than life, and you know, gives a bounce of your comic screwball energy to every scene. And it was great to see, you know, those guys have chemistry and do their thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What is John Boyega's character going through in this? There's the sort of the mystical part of this movie where he's talking with Tim Blake Nelson, and they're talking about numbers and things like that, but he's also seeing like sign glitches and things that are going on in the world I don't think it's necessarily a spoiler, but I'll avoid that a little bit. When he talks to Tim Blake Nelson at the end, there's a revelation that I don't think he or anybody in the audience would connect to, the singularity that they're talking about in the movie. But what is Boyega's character going through in this?
Well, he's a young, idealistic, you know, a public defender who is, you know, probably believe that he could do more good than he currently is because of the nature of the machine that he's up against. And, you know, and so we see sort of a few instances of the, you know, petty injustices to folks whose lives are, you know, irrevocably changed because of really technicalities or, you know, just sort of the systemic, small fry injustice that happens every day. And I think he thought that he could be be sort of a wrench in those gears a lot more than he is. You know, like Sergio, the author, always described to me that, like, when a public defender walks into that building and he's literally the only person in that building that's trying to stop what that building is trying to do. That building wants people to go to jail. And the public defender is the only person in that building that doesn't want them to go to jail. And so, you know, I think he just thought he could be more effective. he is discovering that he, you know, that there's not much he can do, and it's frustrating. So when we're jumping into the movie, I think he's, you know, he's sort of at this crisis point of, you know, there's only so much I can do. And, you know, he's obviously, he keeps kind of pushing it with the judge because he's seeing that, you know, he's trying to do as many workarounds as he can, and nothing's quite kind of working.
Linda Lavin is, you know, obviously just, it's awful, the character she's playing in this, but man, I love her so much in this. I think she's so good in this movie. She really brings it. I know that she's been steadily working for a long time, so it's not a surprise, but how good is Linda Lavin, by the way? Just how good is she?
She is so good. And you know, that was sort of the trick with that, like, casting choice, right? Is you want to, you know, those exchanges between her and John, and, you know, the Cymbeline, the judge, and Cassie, the lawyer, are supposed to be, you know, there's respect there, but there's also, you know, and there's a little, you know, we wanted to get the humor too, right? Like, she's not just this monster that's wanting to throw people in jail. She's a capable person who's been doing this for 30 or 40 years, and she's seen a gazillion, you know, people who are guilty every day. So she is, you know, she's acting not irrationally. And she also, you know, she just brings a sense of humor and like a playfulness to it, you know, that there's a bit of a competition, right? Like, I always look at, like, whenever Cassie went into the courtroom, we talked about it being, they're like mini heists. Like, he's trying to, you know, smuggle out somebody from the vault, right? And she's trying to keep them in the vault. And so there's a bit of competition between them that you know, we're trying to get. And, you know, because Linda Lavin is so great in this, she's not just some faceless demon. She feels like, you know, there's that she's in on the joke. She's in on the sportsmanship between the two of them. And I love her performance, and you know, nobody else could have done what she did to help make that character, you know, work and make those scenes work. So,
okay, so Chase, I don't want to compare this film to other films, but I'm going to. Okay, I hope that's okay, because there's so much going on in this that, and this is. This is your feature debut, is that correct?
Yeah. I shot a couple of short films, but as a director, this is the feature.
Well, I'm so impressed by this because I have not read this book, but this book seems almost very difficult, if not impossible, to adapt to the screen. And I think about a movie like Inherent Vice, and I think about a film like, even, you know, well, I mean, not from a book, but like Tenet, Southland Tales, Heist, you know, these great directors that have tackled challenging materials. And I would even say that the courtroom scene between the judge and Cassie, the back and forth with the camera, reminded me very much of the scene in Whiplash with Damien Chazelle. And again, I don't want to compare it because this is a very unique movie, but how much were you influenced by, obviously those are a bunch of contemporary directors, but like how much were you influenced by, classic films or contemporary films to inform how you wanted to translate this from the page?
Oh, I mean, listen, all those are great comps in terms of stuff that I love and would be and am influenced by, both in general and I think specifically, you know, for this, you know, this film. I mean, you know, like I said, with the influences, right? Like in terms of like comps and figuring out where this movie kind of falls within, like, you know, the larger conversation that people are having when they make films. You start with like the Sergio voice, like I said, but you're trying to manage, you know, I'm trying to juggle these different tonal kind of, you know, moments in the film, right? You got sort of the Sidney Lumet sort of Dog Day Afternoon, you know, like the 70s New York kind of.
And Justice for All, right? Like just kind of, yeah.
Exactly. And Justice for All that stuff at the beginning of the film. And you have the Elmore Leonard, you know, influenced, you know, sort of petty thieves criminality at the on the back half of this. And, you know, and then in the, you know, and then laced throughout these, this sort of, you know, these ripples, this metaphysical, like flight of fancy stuff. And so, you know, I kind of knew what movies we had to watch to kind of, you know, get influence for the pieces of the film, but it was very hard to come up with something that actually we were, you know, right there kind of.
No,
like,
it doesn't map onto like anything whole, for sure. Yeah. It's,
And I, you know, and I like, you know, like Southland Tales is actually great. Like I, you know, I love Richard Kelly. I think he's so ambitious, even when stuff doesn't like fully
right,
gel,
right,
yeah. You know, and even with this, like, listen, I knew we were taking a swing on certain things and in the movie may not be, you know, for everybody and it may work on certain levels for some people and not on, on others. But I like taking the swing, you know, I like trying to kind of bring it all together in this like unique tone. And as a filmmaker, especially as a first-time filmmaker, you just get to play in so many sandboxes your first time out too. You know, I get to like do these courtroom scenes and figure out how to block them and try to make them, you know, our own. And then, you know, this, the heist stuff. And so, you know, just from a challenging yourself creatively aspect, it was a really fun movie to take on and gives you an opportunity to play, you know, in a lot of different, you know,
you
sandboxes.
Did. Okay. So like the it's a legal drama. I wrote this down. It's a legal drama. It's a thriller. It's a heist film. It's a sci-fi film. And it's comedic throughout. I have no idea how you juggled all that stuff. How did you have any direct influence over the screenplay, the adaptation from the book, especially with your background in screenwriting?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I adapted the book and turned it into sort of my own voice or whatever the voice of the movie is, you know, now. I mean, I spent a year basically developing it, taking, you know, there's this original draft by David Matthews. You know, there's some elements in there that were great kind of starting points, mostly at the, you know, in the front end. And then I just went deep into the book and brought that stuff in. And you just try to, you know, you write and rewrite to get a tone. You know, there's this great Alexander Payne quote, right, about, you know, tone wasn't built in a day. And it really is this constant, you know, it's nice. Just, you're constantly fighting, right? You're constantly adding and then pulling stuff back and trying to see how it feels and reads. And that doesn't, that, and that just keeps on happening through the editorial process. You know, our editor, Katie McQuarrie, who worked with the Coen brothers for, you know, a big swath of her career, you know, that she was their assistant on, you know, on most of their stuff in the 2000s. And, you know, they are very good at mm-hmm. balancing mm-hmm. tone, right, with sort of different genres. So she was a big, you know, a big help and a big influence in terms of us trying to find, manage all the kind of, you know, balls in the air and try to find a unified tone for this thing, which, you know, the good thing is we knew what we wanted and we knew what we were shooting for. It was just, you know, a hard thing to try to get right. And you still, you know, like everything, you still, you know, we'll see.
No, that's something that you don't hear about people talk about, right? Is the tone of the film. You hear about the practicalities of shooting and getting the coverage and getting the performances and all that. But it sounds like tone starts from the very first draft all the way through to pre-production, production, post-production, editing. You don't have it until you have it. That's a stupid question, right? But like, you don't have it until you have it. You don't know it until you see it, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I think you have it in your head and you have it, you sort of have it in your, you know, you can hear it somewhere in your head, but you're still trying to get, you know, match what you hear in your head to the reality of what you're watching, you know? And I think, you know, music plays a big part of it. I mean, you know, I think originally we started flirting with like doing, you know, something closer to like the Henry Mancini sort of influence stuff that like Soderbergh nice. Did.
Yeah.
But that didn't work. It felt too comedic or too sort of goofy. And then, you know, just trying to find like the balance of like, how do you have that comedy in the music? And the sort of, you know, the workaday, you know, he's going to the factory, the criminal factory at the beginning, but at the end, you're sort of dealing with the heist stuff and these like, you know, sci-fi elements that have their own musical kind of chords. And how does that all work together? And so that was a big, you know, thing we had to wrestle with. And that helps with tone, you know, very much. And then with the actors all have to be on the same page too, you know, tonally. And I think the easy way that we did it was just basically say, hey, like, you all have to, you each of you take your character seriously. Like, you're from your character's perspective, like, this is dead serious. Like, you want something, you believe that you are on the right course to get it. And you're all sort of, you know, smart people competing against each other to kind of, you know, further your agenda, and never play it for comedy, or never play it for, you know, the heightened quality. Try to, like, be your character and take your character seriously. And if everybody's taking their character seriously, then maybe the performances will all feel cohesive, even if we're sort of, you know, swinging wildly in tone from, you know, some of the early philosophical stuff to the later kind of the spasms of violence. So yeah, you know, it's a constant conversation. But this was so much fun about making movies, is you're having these conversations with all these smart people, and you're just all trying to figure it out and hoping you've come up with something that feels unique and people might enjoy it.
There was another movie that popped into my head, and it's one that you worked on, actually. The movie Pie came up in my head when I was watching this, because of the Tim Blake Nelson character finding patterns in the world through mathematics and everything. Is that something that's in the book, or is that something that you added, or that David Matthews may have added?
No, that was in the book. That was sort of not in the original, you know, the original script. It was, there's a lot of philosophy. I would say, like, you know, 300 pages of the book is Dane trying to convince Cassie to go do this heist. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is, you know, it's just endless sort of philosophical banter back and forth about the nature of the, you know, world and the fairness and, you know, the you know, justification for, you know, pulling off this heist. And it's really funny and it's crazy. And so a lot of that banter, that philosophical banter, ended up, you know, being pulled, you know, in both the direction of, like, you know, the Dane banter that you see, and then also the Tim Blake Nelson character. There's also another character in the book, like another lawyer that would come into Cassie's office and talk about the nature of the universe. And, you know, and so there, that got folded into yet another character that was his next door neighbor, who was obsessed with pop culture and, you know, may or may not have turns into, you know, Jackie Gleason of the Honeymooners. And it's very strange sort of interaction, but, like, it was collapsing all these disparate characters who had worthy things to say into, you know, the character of Tim Blake Nelson, basically. And, you know, and he's like, yeah, you know, and he's trying to, you know, and the movie has this sort of metaphoric kind of overarching kind of idea, you know, in the naked singularity. And, you know, I wanted to have somebody in the movie address it, you know, in a way. And so that's what Tim's doing.
It says on here, I'm sorry to divert to Pie. I know that you were, it's list you as additional crew on this credit and everything. Can you tell me a little bit of what that was like? Cause this is Darren Aronofsky's first feature. And I know, I think you guys are both Brooklyn based and everything, although you're moving and everything now, but what was experience like on that movie?
I was just out of college. I was only on it as a PA for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And it was, I didn't know what I was witnessing, to be perfectly honest. You know, it was,
yeah. I don't think a lot of people knew what they were witnessing, yeah, I mean, even as they were watching the film.
Right. It's like Maddie Libetic and, you know, Aronofsky's, like, all these amazing guys, and it was in a warehouse in Queens, I believe, and his mom was catering with Italian food. You know, it was,
that sounds delightful.
Yeah, I mean, it was very DIY, and I think, as a, you know, is it was like my first summer out of college, and I was trying to figure out how to get into the film business and didn't even know how a set worked, and I didn't understand what I was sort of seeing and how it was going to, you know, where it was going to go. So the cool thing was I got to be on that set and it was my first taste of seeing what, like, an indie film set looks like. But that was a very brief experience. It was hard. It's hard being a PA, not working, not getting paid, working 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
You're like,
no kidding.
I'm done with this. Yeah, it was so it was a short-lived experience. Didn't really get to know any of those guys, but it was cool, very cool to be there at that time. And obviously, it was, you know, that time in New York City filmmaking, which is why I moved there and have lived there.
This is a very New York film, The Naked Singularity. It was this filmed in New York. It seems like there's a lot of, you know, love letters to not only the glitzy New York that you see, of course, all the time, portrayed in rom-coms and stuff. But this is the, like the actual New York, the people living by the trains, the view from Jersey looking over onto the shoreline, right? What New York is a character in this movie, right?
Yeah, I love the city. This was meant to be a love letter to it. I've lived in Brooklyn most of the 20 some years I was there. And we shot in New York. We shot in every borough. Wow. We shot on location in the, at 100 Center Street, all the courtroom stuff was there. And, I lived in Williamsburg. So, I spent many a Saturday walking through, the Hasidic neighborhood next door, which is just very quiet and lovely. And, just I've been there for years, like just wondering about what could possibly be going on here that I'm not seeing. The solidarity of the community, I thought was a really interesting shield to if there was a nefarious actor, that solidarity gives them a cloak, and I thought that would be interesting to sort of play with. I wish we had more time in the movie to sort of, go into that and clarify with, that with those characters, but we were moving pretty fast. But that was, I got to walk the set, on those days. And so shooting in New York was a dream, honestly. And my DP, Andrea Parca, who, shot my short films, he's a New York, based DP. And, he just won an Emmy for Succession. And he's been in the city for a very long time. Like, we've all been in New York for a long time and wanted to shoot the city that we know. And we sort of had our working kind of motto was, we want to shoot a movie that was like the vinyl record version of a contemporary band. So nice. It was, it was like a retro New York, but it was
no, that's perfect. That's art. A perfect encapsulation of how this film feels.
Oh, good. Good. And that, it was helpful. It oriented everybody, and also because the film is a little weird and wild and has its own tone, we thought that like that slightly heightened version of, the Shaggy Dog New York would help kind of, unify it tonally as well, because it makes it specific and not, makes it real, but not real to an extent.
I did want to talk, though, we hadn't really talked much about Olivia Cooke, and, another genre I thought this film played around with was film noir, because Olivia Cooke felt very, like, Barbara Stanwyck-esque, like, with her, you never really knew exactly what was going on, and the way she was playing everybody and stuff. I thought she was fantastic in this. I don't think I've ever seen her give a performance like this, which was really interesting.
She's a terrific actress. I saw her in Thoroughbreds, which is sort of what got me most just excited to meet her, and she just brought it. I mean, the nails and the hair extensions, that was her. She really
and
wanted
the accent
to,
oh my
accent,
god,
yeah. Yeah, the accent was all her, and she really built the character.
That's
from
awesome.
From the ground up. And our great costume designer kind of made her look, fabulous and strong. And yeah, I mean, she was a femme fatale in the way in which, she was one step ahead of every other guy in this film, which I felt made her empowered and made her an awful lot of fun. We've been getting, that I think that the reaction to her character particularly, which, was on one level, nervous about, because she's still a criminal, but we're rooting for her, and she's an extraordinary actress. She gives you so many different, options when you're doing takes with her. She's always, on, and she's a lovely person and was just super prepared. So I her performance is one of my favorites in the film. And I think she's
You just don't see characters like that anymore. That's why I went with Stanwyck, because I was trying to think of anybody, because even like Kathleen Turner in Body Heat, who's excellent, but she's more just straight up villain. The layers that you and Olivia Cooke and her performance, did and everything, it just felt more like that classic femme fatale, and it was very cool. The other thing I did want to ask about, I noticed the list of producers. There were some interesting names on there. I mean, I know this is Scott Free, so obviously Ridley was involved, but I saw Dick Wolf was on there, and Ryan Fleck, who I guess most people might know as directing Captain Marvel, but he also did A Half Nelson and Sugar. I was curious how much they were involved, or were they attached to earlier, because I know you said this has been development for a while.
Yeah, everyone in different ways. So So Dick Wolf, Tony Gann's the producer who optioned this and developed it. he works with Dick. So I think, gotcha. I think Dick was involved in so far as he was, you know, supporting the development. We never had conversations, but he was, to be perfectly honest, they did help us with like some of the uniforms and stuff, with their connections to Law and Order. So, you know, we're an indie movie.
Oh, nice.
Any little thing helps. So they, you know, that relationship, it did actually, you know, really come through in production. Ryan Fleckin and Anna Boden, I've known cool. for a gazillion years. They also, you know, a lot of their movies were shot also by Andre. So we know each other through that, and they were attached. They were basically attached through that last draft with David Matthews. And when I came on board, they were still intending to direct, but very early on, they got the Captain Marvel film and dropped off.
What's wrong with them?
It was just me. And I,
yeah. Right. I mean, they could tell Marvel to wait. For God's sake.
I know. So it was, you know, I wanted to work with those guys because I really liked them a lot, but it happened so early in the process. And it was really, I'd sort of come to them with sort of how I would re-break the film, you know, really sort of leaning on the book. And once they left, we all agreed that, like, let me just write the script mm-hmm. and then we'll think about, you know, filmmakers kind of later. And, you know, and as I was writing it for me. And when I finished the script, you know, Tony and everybody was very excited about it. And, you know, I asked if I could direct, and they were supportive because we spent a year developing it, and I knew the script, and, you know, they trusted me. So it was a great experience all around. And all of those folks, you know, I had a few early conversations with Ryan and Anna that, you know, they're little morsels here and there that certainly their ideas got scattered in. So
very cool. I was also curious how the casting of Kyle Mooney happened. That's just an interesting choice for, you know, the infamous Gollum.
I know. Well, I was trying, you know, we're having fun in the movie with that sort of outfit, you know, and I kind of wanted to nod to the fact that we're having a little bit of fun with that. I wish we had more time, and I actually wrote more scenes with him. It's the nature of production. You got what you got, but that's why I did it. I really like Kyle. I think he's super fun and funny. And I thought that I wanted you to be able to recognize, you know, one of the guys, the Gollum of the group of the Gollum. So you could, you know, you could have that attachment right away, and go from there. So.
God, that was it was perfect.
I guess there's one other actor I'd like to know about is Ed Skrein, because, I haven't seen him in everything that he's in. He blew up since Deadpool, but I haven't seen a lot of the other things that he's been in. But these couple of things that I've seen him in, he has this way of being both evil and charming at the same time and everything. What is it like working with Ed Skrein?
Everybody on set was in love with him.
Man, oh, yeah. Women. I would
guys,
be.
Super charismatic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's so nice. Super charismatic. Really fun presence on set. Very, very cool guy. And we had fun crafting the character. I mean, you know, we were trying to, you know, do what you just said, which was, you know, he's charming and somewhat seedy at the beginning, but there's something, you know, there's something charismatic and sexy about him. But, you know, as things unfold, he obviously, he's like that guy in a bar who is really interesting the first hour, but by hour three, and he corners you with all his crazy talk, you're like, get me out of here.
I don't get him, and I don't think I'm supposed to get him, right? I don't get Craig. Like, there's never a clear angle. It's always oblique. Either, like, you think he's just this, like you said, like a skeezy guy that comes up to Olivia Cooke's character at the beginning, and you figure, you know this guy. And then after they have their tryst, you figure, oh, okay. But then he does something else that you're like, what? And then, you know, when you go with the traditional kind of arc with them, I don't get this character, but I love that I don't get this character. He's so odd up until the very, very end of the film and of his character arc. And I love the way that you and you know, the source material wrote this character and the performance, because you just never see him coming.
Well, I hope that sort of works. I mean, I the one thing that I would, you know, would hope people get a little bit is, you know, out of him is, you know, this sort of idea that you know, both he and Craig, or he and Cassie, see this world, you know, see the sort of the injustice and or the sort of, you know, the inequality of the world.
Right.
And he, you know, he's totally misdiagnosed the problem with this crazy lizard.
Exactly.
He's a little like, yeah. And we were talking about, you know, QAnon when we were writing this. Like, we're like, what is that person? This is just somebody who's like seeing a fucked up world, which is we all are seeing, and it's fair to ask questions about why is it this way. But then there's this just crazy ass, you know, different approach to interpreting it that I wanted him to reflect in, you know, and maybe that would help us sort of grab onto his motives a little bit. And so, you know, that part of it is, you know, was something we were interested in exploring, and whether people fully get it or not, or they just get him as the charming, you know, psychopath, you know, we'll see. You know,
that explains it perfectly, because I don't get Q people either. So no, that's absolutely, he's the encapsulation of that whole insane movement. So that's perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. I love him. He's fun. And like you said, like great actor. I'd like to see him, you know, play. I think he can do all sorts of really interesting, diverse stuff, not just the baddies. So.
No doubt. Jonathan Barrett, anything else before we close out?
Oh man, I could go on all day about this film. This film is so wild. What is the, what? Okay. Can I ask you one thing about it? Actually,
yeah,
one
of
thing,
course.
maybe a couple of things about it.
Sure.
So you were involved in the official It, which is It Chapter One, correct? This was your screenplay. It's gotta be goddamn insane to adapt not only a Stephen King story, but one of the most beloved popular properties of the modern era. How did that start, and how did that progress to where, okay, I've got what we need to move forward with this screenplay?
I think the fact that we broke it into two movies, I mean, that's, you know, that was our first good choice, because it gives you just so much more space to make the films. And then, you know, you look at, once you break the two movies, then you have two genres that are different, right? Like the first one's an Amblin movie, because it's kids, and the second one's like the Big Chill, right? Where they come together. So just by doing that allows you more breathing room than sort of going back and forth and doing the whole book. And I think that was like the best, like that got the whole thing started on the right foot. I know before we came in, there was a draft that tried to do everything, you know, and all in one draft. And
you just can't
do it. So once we did that, then it was just like, you know, then we got to write an Amblin movie. I mean, that was our number one sort of a piece of agenda, was like, how do we make this feel like we felt when we were watching, you know, The Goonies and Stand By Me and all that stuff, kids on bikes. And then you happen to have the scary clown and the weird shit in some of the iconic, you know, set pieces that, you know, when you're adapting that book, obviously you're going to have Meebolt Street. You're going to have Bev with the, you know, blood coming out of the sink. You're going to have the face off at the end. And obviously the Georgie great, you know, opening, like there's just things that of course you're going to have. And then I think we just brought a lot of ourselves to the banter of the kids. Like that's what I'm proudest of about that film, is that all the character, like liking the kids and the character work, and how we were able to sort of get, you know, get seven characters who most of whom don't even know each other together in a half hour. You know, that was a trick, you know, how do you sort of corral everybody and care about them and stuff like that. And that is what I love most about that first movie. It's just all the kids stuff. You know, and obviously some of the scares are great, but it's the kids stuff and, you know, and what Bill did with Pennywise that I think makes that first movie work.
You talk about tone. That's the perfect tone. That's the perfect tone for that film. You've got so many subtle scares in there along with the more overt ones. But the chemistry, man, that quarry scene, just every interaction with that cast was believable. And, you know, especially Finn Wolfhard and the rest of the kids and Sophia Lillis and that realistic dialogue. Thank God it was R-rated, because that's how kids talk. Exactly.
It would have been ridiculous if it was. It wouldn't have felt authentic to what we were trying to get done.
It's a magic trick how you adapted that The book is obviously, you know, a classic, a modern classic, but the way that you adapted that, I think that film is going to be a modern classic. I've revisited it
absolutely
many times. I know Jonathan and Chris have too. It's just, it's an absolute gem. And I really appreciate how you somehow, you're right, you know, cutting it in half. Usually you get Mockingjay when you cut things in half. Sorry. But this was a good idea. This was a good idea to cut something in half.
It's fun. We've now talked to two people who worked on it. We talked with Aaron Sims, the guy who did the visual effects, we've talked to a screenwriter on it now. So yeah, maybe we can get the whole collection someday. But
hey, Chase, can you hook us up with Bill? You know Bill. Can you get him on the show? It's all right.
I'll talk to him. I think the man's busy doing John Wick 4, I guess, right now. It sounds like.
Well, there you go. Who knows,
that's awesome.
I don't know if he's the villain or what his deal is, but that'll be fun to see.
We'd like to thank Chase Palmer for giving us his time. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, guys. This is really enjoyable. Thanks for all the questions and letting me talk about the weird, wild movie we all watched.
Yeah. It's so much fun. I have not seen a movie like this. I mentioned the comparisons, but I've never seen a movie like this. And I really appreciate swinging for the fences, man. I very much enjoyed it.
Oh man. Well, thanks guys. I really, really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on. It's fun to talk.
The movie's Naked Singularity. It comes out in theaters August 8th, on demand August 13th. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkins and Jonathan Watkins and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.